This is the Crime Story Podcast with Carrie Antholis, where stories of crime and justice are told. On today's podcast, Sean Smith reads his story, The Durst Trial, A Brother Remembers His Lost Sister, which you can find in written form at crimestory.com.
Like so many memories, this one is jogged by a photograph. Deputy DA John Lewin projects an image of a pre-adolescent Kathy Durst onto the courtroom's oversized video monitors. From his seat in the witness box, James McCormick, Kathy's 76-year-old brother, turns to consider it.
Do you recognize who's in that photo?
Yes.
And who is that?
That is my baby sister Kathy, sitting in the rowboat that my dad bought and the motor that I bought.
And any idea when approximately this would have been taken?
Early 60s, I had graduated from high school, you know, earned some money for, you know, my night job, day job, whatever you want to call it, extra job, applied it as a graduation gift to an outboard motor.
The associations well up for McCormick, moments and places and people never to be encountered again. But they live on in his recollection, vivid with color, emotion, and the exact angle of the sunlight.
Can you describe, growing up, what was your relationship like with Kathy? Were the two of you close?
I would consider it close, yes. She was the baby of the family. My dad loved her. First time I ever held an infant was 1952, late June. My mom had come home from the hospital, and I was out of school. I had to be out of school because it was the middle of the day, June, late June. Sun was off to my right shoulder. Mom comes down the stoop. We call them stoops in St. Albans house, and put Kathy in my arms, and I admittedly still remember being like in a clumsy state, and I quickly gave Kathy back to my mom. That was the first time I was engaged with Kathy, and thereafter she was just the baby of the family.
In a very real sense, all testimony concerns the past and witness recollections of the details of that past. In their questioning of James McCormick, the people and the defense drilled down into very different types of memory with divergent results. Lewin, whose courtroom style tends to be crisp, was caring and empathic with McCormick, tapping into a rich emotional vein. Via respectful questions, Lewin conjured up Kathy as a little girl, the apple of her family's eye, later maturing into a young woman, an A student, and the rising star of an ambitious Irish-American clan. Lewin simultaneously evoked a lost world, New York City's outer boroughs of the 70s, where young women modeled for matrons at Long Island shopping centers like Roosevelt Field and the Manhasset Mall, and high school seniors spent their savings on outboard motors and then went on the road in secondhand Dodge vans. A young Robert Durst also appears in these reminiscences of simpler times.
I remember having Bob come out to New Hyde Park, and from there, he and a bunch of my buddies at the time, we were all bachelors, went fishing down on the South Shore on a party boat, headboat they used to call them, and Bob got violently sick. Him and another friend spent most of that boat ride puking into the bucket.
Handling McCormick almost as a therapist would a patient, Lewin teases out other poignant recollections of that lost time. McCormick's intimate lakeside chats with Kathy when they would, quote, talk about everything, family dynamics, you know, her plans and her doctor dreams, end quote. Kathy staying with James and his pregnant wife Sharon, then sending a vase of roses to congratulate them on the birth of their daughter. Gradually, though, Lewin edges McCormick towards a darker place where memory sours and trauma and foreboding loom.
And can you describe, was there an incident that occurred at one of these holiday gatherings?
Yes.
Can you please describe, to the best of your memory, what happened?
Yeah, there was a Christmas gathering at my mom's house. We had our sit-down dinner, and then the sit-down dinner led to, an after-dinner cocktail. We were in my mom's living room, and I was on this end of the couch, and Kathy was on this end of the couch.
Indicating opposite ends of the couch for the record.
Opposite ends of the couch, as close as I am to this gentleman. And opposite me was my grandma. She was Grandma Soft. She was going to be 90 that year. And Bob had, started the process of going home, but he had to warm up the diesel. It was a 210 diesel, which is a diesel that, you know, you had to put half a gallon of gasoline into the diesel fuel just to keep it from freezing in the wintertime. So he went out to warm up the car, and he was kind of like impatient. And Kathy was sitting there with a glass of red wine. I had a bottle of beer. And unfortunately, I probably will be thinking of this till the day I die. But the next thing I know, Bob insisted that she get up. And Kathy wanted to continue her conversation because the glass wasn't empty with myself and my grandma. And you know, he got impatient. He went out, and then he came back in very quickly, walked over as quickly as like, you know, a very quick step, grabbed Kathy by the top of her head like that, and yanked her, and she went with the yank. The way it happened, it was so spontaneous and unexpected. I mean, you really go into a temporary state of shock, like, you know, it's like a lightning bolt. And the next thing you know, Kathy got up and was going with Bob, and they went literally to the door when I'm still sitting there, like, in shock, literal shock. And Kathy's coat was on the bench by the door. It's where Mom used to keep the, where you store your coats when you come to visit. She grabbed the coat and she turned and she said something to the effect, "It's all right, Jim." And then she went out the door, and that was the end of that.
Lewin asks McCormick about his sister Kathy's hopes to become a doctor, his frustration with the NYPD's investigation of his sister's disappearance, and the seemingly unemotional reaction of her husband, Bob Durst. Lewin crafts a portrait of Jim McCormick as a shattered survivor, burdened with what he later termed, quote, 38 years of pain and suffering, end quote. McCormick is also not alone in his decades-long ordeal. Late in his direct, Lewin asks McCormick about the effect of Kathy's disappearance on their widowed mother. She died in 2016 at the age of 102, haunted by the mystery of Kathy's fate.
Did she ever get over the loss of her youngest daughter?
I don't believe so. I think she kind of put it on a shelf at times, but at times, I mean, when I'd go visit my mom, I still remember when she was becoming more infirm, physically more infirm, her mind was still sharp. I'd go visit her, and she had a room in the back with a TV where she could sit and watch her shows. And she, first thing she'd have would be the stack of the New York Times weekend edition, which we gave to her as a subscription gift. And she'd have the real estate pages open. And she frequently, and I swear on a Bible, which I already have, you know, the subject would come up, and she goes, "Oh, the Durst, watch yourself. They're powerful people." I mean, that was the way my mom's mind was right into her, you know, maybe 100th birthday.
The defense, led by Dick DeGaren, shows comparatively little sympathy or respect for the missing Kathy Durst. At the start of his cross-examination of McCormick, DeGaren did not greet the witness or introduce himself. Instead, the Houston attorney launched directly into a line of questioning related to McCormick's cooperation with NYPD detectives responsible for Kathy's case. DeGaren projects the image of a missing flyer from 1982 seeking information about Kathy's disappearance, noting that the McCormick family had actively collaborated on the flyer with NYPD detective Mike Strzok. DeGaren alleges that Strzok was simultaneously, quote, developing witnesses that had seen. Lewin objects before DeGaren finishes his sentence, but DeGaren's intention is clear. Without providing any evidence, he hopes to suggest that the NYPD bungled its investigation and tainted the McCormick family's search for truth, unfairly leaving Robert Durst in the crosshairs. Judge Mark E. Windham sustains the objection, but Lewin presses his point, resulting in a heated exchange.
Can the jury be instructed immediately, Your Honor? The court's already ruled on this.
Yeah,
that's no accident.
Yeah, so
it's not an accident.
No, it took time out.
Door's open.
The door's not open. Okay. May we approach, Your Honor?
Will you just relax for a second?
May I
speak? Time out.
It's okay. I'm breathing.
Okay. No, breathing.
I'm trying.
More slowly, Mr. DeGaren. Concentrate on the out-breath.
In his characteristically Zen manner, Windham then repeats his earlier instruction to the jury that neither the attorney's remarks or questions are evidence. DeGaren's sideways approach to cross-examination continues. He focuses on what he calls a timeline that he alleges McCormick devised using Kathy's phone records. In what can only be considered a strategic miscalculation, DeGuerin shows McCormick some 10 pages of phone records, hoping to refresh his recollection. Minutes pass in awkward silence as McCormick puzzles over the pages. Phone records from almost 40 years ago? In the hands of the surviving sibling of a tragically missing young woman? At the very least, it makes for bad optics. More minutes pass. Always conscious of the ticking clock, Wyndham finally intercedes, reminding McCormick that, quote, after you've read it, just answer the question whether it refreshes your recollection, without saying anything more, end quote. McCormick seems genuinely confused by the document, but not by DeGuerin's intention. He hopes to suggest yet again that an incompetent NYPD investigation was further muddied by McCormick's amateur sleuthing. Wyndham muses aloud about whether McCormick is the, quote, right witness for these things, end quote. One journalist later speculates that DeGuerin confused Jim McCormick with another of Kathy's siblings and was asking him questions that the defense intended for that other sibling. This would be the latest in a string of blunders by the Houston attorney. See Defending Robert Durst, The Opening Statement by Karen Ann Coburn, March 23, 2020. In short order, the defense's first two lines of questioning are thwarted, with DeGuerin's bedside manner reading as tone-deaf and unnecessarily aggressive. It's at this point that DeGuerin begins to flail. He shuttles between the jinx and McCormick's relationship with the film's directors, Kathy's alleged cocaine abuse, and a ham-fisted examination of the terrorist incident recounted by Ann Anderson Doyle. None of this lands with any resonance. DeGuerin seems to be running down a laundry list, looking for something that might stick. What's obvious is that in these first days of testimony, the defense does not have a thoughtful strategy for how to handle McCormick. As a last resort, DeGuerin asks McCormick about notes written to Kathy by her medical school instructors, missives suggesting that she was having academic and attendance difficulties in the months leading up to her disappearance. To repeat Judge Wyndham's concern, is McCormick the right witness for these things? What possible good could come of asking Kathy's bereaved brother to overturn his memories of her? Instead of radically separating Kathy Durst from Susan Berman, the defense seems to have become tangled in the weeds of the people's expansive theory of the case, positioning Kathy smack in the middle of the proceedings, rather than rendering her irrelevant. It's a misstep, the consequences of which will be fascinating to follow.
That was The Durst Trial, A Brother Remembers His Lost Sister, by Sean Smith. For more crime and justice storytelling news and narrative analysis, head over to crimestory.com. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next Crime Story podcast.